Welcome to another episode of the Reboot Chronicles, a no-holds-barred forum with global leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and CEOs about how organizations stay focused on growth and innovation in unprecedented times. I'm your host, Dean DeBias, coming to you live from Reviv's North American headquarters in Chicago, and we would like to thank you for joining us from around the globe today. I'd like to welcome Jeff Jones, the president and CEO of H&R Block, to the Reboot Chronicles. Previously, he was an exec at Target, Coke, and Gap, and oh yeah, he was the president of Uber. Can't wait to hear some of those stories. Jeff knows how to scale stuff and to do turnarounds as well. He's basically been rebooting H&R Block into the 21st century over the last almost a decade now. Founded in 1955, the tax prep leader has a storied history. With a footprint larger than many retailers, the $3.5 billion behemoth has 10,000 locations with 60,000 tax pros who filed 20 million returns last year alone for people and small businesses. And they're soon going to pass the 1 billion return mark. Sounds like a good time to have a party. Jeff, good to see you.
You too, Dean. Thank you. Love the intro.
I read that you guys somehow got 5 million people to switch over to your platform last year. Did I read that right?
This business, if you think about consumer taxes, everybody is already filing taxes with someone. So big part of what we have to do, we got to retain our clients and we got to get people to switch. And so we're very, very aggressive, especially against TurboTax, to get people to switch. More people leave TurboTax every year in the software business than we have as clients.
TurboTax being into it, right?
Exactly.
It's funny, we had the CEO of Intuit on. He didn't mention that.
I bet he didn't.
Why is that? The churn and burn business, we all deal with that, especially in the SaaS business.
Yeah.
Why is it so high? Don't people just want to hang on to their current platform, or is it yours more the personal touch?
I think what we learn is, especially with TurboTax, they are very aggressive at upselling people. And so the consumer gets very frustrated. They think they're starting out for free and then they end up paying a couple $100 or whatever the number is. And people also believe it's very hard to switch. And so we've made it really, really easy to switch from TurboTax. Literally, click of a button, we go get your last year's return. We automatically import it into H&R Block. And we've just, taken the mindset of being a challenger brand and really going after the market leader in DIY, which is them. They're one, we're number two.
Wow. This is not your father's H&R Block. Well, maybe that's a good place to restart this is, you guys are more than just tax filing. I know I didn't get into all that in the intro, but, everything from financial planning to financial products, business solutions, especially SMB. What's the state of the company today?
I'm really proud that the state of the company is very good right now. When I joined the company in the fall of 17, I was the sixth CEO in 10 years.
Wow.
And so the company had been through a tremendous amount of change, but very little progress. Our revenue was flat. Our clients were declining. Our 20-year stock TSR was zero. And so we just have been on this mission to improve the quality, modernize the company, and to diversify what we do. We may get into this. We have a long history of diversification, and we're doing it very differently this time. But today, beyond consumer tax, we do small business tax, bookkeeping, payroll. We have two different consumer lending products. We have a reloadable debit card. And we have a challenger bank, a mobile banking platform called Spruce. We're also in the SaaS business for small business with a company called Wave that we own. So just in simple terms, digitize everything, improve the quality, and diversify. And, I didn't check our stock price today, but, we've been setting new all-time highs pretty consistently. And so on almost every metric, we're really, really performing well right now.
Yeah, it seems like you stabilized the ship and rebooted it, and probably now are the longest standing CEO besides the founder. You guys did go through a lot of them. I knew a couple of those.
We sure CEOs. Did.
How do you stay relevant with Gen X, Y, Z, Alpha? I'm surprised you haven't changed your name to some cool, you know, HRB thing or what's going on there?
You know, it's so funny. We haven't changed our name, but we certainly talk about ourselves as Block. Just that simple change in name seems more relevant to younger people.
Yep.
We're also doing some really interesting stuff. Right now, this year, we launched something called Responsibility Island. You can go find it. This is reality TV made for Gen Z. And our teams are getting a lot of credit in the content creation world for doing things like that. It's what we do, most people have to do, but connecting on modern terms, using different platforms, and frankly, being willing to break the mold of being a conservative tax company is a real key, not only to our general success, but especially reaching younger consumers.
Yeah, I bet. But you're still heavy duty location based. Do they care about that?
They do. And it's always surprising to people. A year ago, I don't know where this data will play out this year, but half of all of our new clients that came into an office were millennial.
Wow.
One of the things I learned, because Dean, I came from outside this business. I had no tax or financial services experience before I came here, is I always say to people, just because you're tech savvy doesn't mean you're tax savvy. And so people like the comfort of knowing there's a human who's doing the work, and I can count on them to get me the best outcome possible. And, you know, we've got major AI deployments happening right now. The whole business is digital. You never have to go to an office if you don't want to. But we just see people tend to want to have that personal relationship.
Yeah. And, you know, 10,000 locations, that's a huge network. I did a search this morning just to see where you are, and all these locations popped up. I mean, it's probably easier since most of them are. Are they all franchises?
No, only one third are franchise.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. So you really are running that network. Way back in the early retail days, my dad was a big wig at Sears and Montgomery Wards. No one knows what that is anymore. But they, you know, he started co-locating H&R Blocks in all these stores, and then Walmart did it. Are you still doing those co-lo things, or
we don't anymore?
In the season, or?
No, outside the U.S., in Canada, we do co-locations and pop-ups. Inside the U.S., you know, we rent all of our locations. We've got some pretty good flexibility to move them as we need to. And so our footprint is strong, but we don't do any more co-locations.
Wow, that's amazing. So when you look at things like the product roadmap, so you mentioned, you know, financing. So we've had some of the challenger banks on, the neobanks, debit credit card guys, you know, everybody kind of going after the big dogs of financial, the big nine banks. You know, just how do you see your business playing out in terms of multiple fronts, multiple categories? Where do you see yourselves going?
I mean, it sounds like a bit of a soundbite, but how we talk about it internally is building a financial platform for Main Street America. And that means continuing to evolve the way we serve hardworking Americans. You know, we're not a high-end company. We're not trying to compete, you know, with a Marcus and a Goldman Sachs or those kind of things. But our brand is highly trusted. We've got tens of millions of people that come to us every year. Really, their most intimate financial transaction. I call the tax form like your financial DNA. It says so much about your life. And we've got about
personal, very personal too.
It's incredibly personal. And so, you know, our ability to leverage that trust, our current client base, our very broad distribution network, that gives us an advantage to move into some new businesses where we're not starting from scratch with a brand or distribution or a built-in market. And that's what we're trying to maximize right now. And, you know, and it's early, but we're having some pretty good success doing it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Many companies, especially public ones that are, you know, headed to 4 billion like you, you know, they come up with all these product extensions where they're actually entering new markets. You're saying, hey, we already have a market. We own this certain segment of the consumer. Let's bring more and more services to them. And hopefully they want to buy more products from us than rather than having three or four vendors. So that seems like it's working.
It has been working. You know, I love the idea of reboot instead of transformation. I don't find transformation's really the right word anymore. You know, everything at the company is changing. I think the leadership challenge is when, you know, you've been on this journey, you're 5 or 6 years in, you're having more success than the company's had in a long, long time, but you're not done. And that's part of the leadership message internally is, great companies are always rebooting. There is no completion of this work. And that's what we have to keep people excited about is what's next, not kind of, you know, celebrating this moment.
Yeah. And just keeping up with competition. There's so much. So when I did the map search on, I came up with so many independent, whatever CPAs, and then I'd see the H&R Block ones come up on the map. It was interesting.
300,000 independents.
Oh gosh. that's a lot of competition. Not to mention you've got all these other companies kind of coming into it. So you mentioned, you know, TurboTax. There's companies like Zoho and 20 others that have it as an app and for small SMBs. So SMBs are bombarded with alternatives.
That's right.
But do you see yourself more as a frenemy with some of those people? Because they're not doing their taxes, but they're pretty much aligning 80% of it week by week. So when it comes time to file, they're ready to rock and roll and hit a button. Is that good for you, having all these enabling platforms out there?
It is. And we certainly have partnerships with different companies. I mean, we're very interested in the early stage technology companies that can build customer experiences.
Yep.
And so we're constantly looking at that market. It's why we made the acquisition of Wave a few years ago.
Right.
A very fast growing SMB platform to do DIY, bookkeeping, payroll, banking, number of things, payments. And so that's an example where we just knew that we could buy or partner and get there much faster than trying to build it on our own.
Yeah, when you look at, you know, we talk a lot about build, buy, borrow in the program. CompuServe comes to mind. You guys bought so many companies in the past and divested some. So you know, M&A is kind of in your culture a little bit. But when you look at building out stuff, how do you decide what you're going to do yourself versus partner with or acquire?
You know, I think you just have to start with core capabilities, right to win, what the market looks like. Obviously, there are many companies. What's the market for acquisition? Where is pricing for acquisitions at any moment in time? You know, again, with Wave, we started out making an investment in the company that turned into an acquisition. That can be a great model as well.
My favorite model. Absolutely.
Yeah, you learn so much in that process. Our core strategy, we call it Block Horizons, is not dependent on M&A. And nice. So, you know, we want to be really judicial when we do it, when we see something that makes sense. But otherwise, it's primarily an organic growth model. We generate a lot of cash, and then we try to deploy that capital in the most efficient way we can.
Yeah, and you're still very seasonal, I'm sure. Speaking of cash, must be fun in April, at least in this country. So when you look at innovation and new product development and extending all these new services, how's AI playing into this? And I know you guys are using Microsoft Azure, and is that a piece of your product planning, or is that just more the hosting platform for you?
Well, we are a Microsoft shop in general, but in particular, you know, a year ago, we were all just discovering ChatGPT, right? I mean, it's very new in the world, but moving so fast. And we were really happy that OpenAI and Microsoft chose us to be their tax partner. And so this year, we've deployed in our do-it-yourself software what we call AI Tax Assist. And listen, it's I don't even know what the right sports analogy is, but it's so early in this game.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not trying to call any victories with AI, whether it's in our DIY or our call center. We're just trying to learn, Dean. And that's just learn, get it in front of the customer, see what choices they make, and use that in the product roadmap to iterate and improve and decide where we go next.
Yep.
But that's our approach.
Well, that's smart, especially you're messing with people's money. You can only automate so much of this. And, you know, Core AI was just on, and they basically are automating all the call centers in the world, and it seems to be working fairly well. But, you know, when it comes down to people's livelihood and taxes, yeah, I'd be a little leery to rely on it. So besides using AI, what other mistakes, what do you see people doing in terms of biggest mistakes they make in their tax-related matters?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I have to go right to the customers that we serve and what we see from our population. Obviously, taxes are so personal. It's a very broad question. But I would say for Main Street America, the biggest mistake they make is not doing tax planning. People treat their outcome every year like it's a big surprise. Oh, my gosh, am I getting a refund or I'm not getting a refund? And for people that have relatively simple lives, income, standard deduction, and some credits, that outcome does not have to be a surprise. If you do a little tax planning, if you make changes to your W-4 and withholdings, you can actually get the outcome you want. Do you want a refund or do you not want a refund? But people aren't engaged in the topic enough. And so they make that mistake, and therefore they're surprised a lot when it comes time to file their taxes.
So rather than waiting till, you know, April of the following year, you should really start January 1st of the year you're in and have
and
some analytics
have
around it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you move, you have a kid, you get married, you get divorced. Those triggers can be a reminder to change your W-4 and have much more control over your tax outcome than most Americans believe they do.
Do you see your expansion plans? You know, I mean, the States is huge, I know, but boy, there's some massive markets out there.
There are, you know, over our long history, we have flirted and more than flirted. We used to do tax prep in India. We've had joint ventures in other companies, but there is something about the places we are and the relationship the consumer has with the government on this topic of taxes. Right. And so we don't, even though there are big populations, we don't see an obvious geography where we want to try to be next.
Yeah. I mean, just keeping up with the tax laws here is probably pretty challenging.
Well, and outside the U.S., the tax laws are so much simpler that actually makes it less advantageous for our business.
What were some of your biggest challenges just personally coming in? I mean, I know you came from different industries, but I'm a huge believer in bringing people in from other industries. So I think that helped the company a lot, especially because you had retail in your background. But yeah, what did you struggle with?
Well, I mean, I think anytime you join a long-tenured organization that had been through a lot of change, I struggled initially with people saying to me, you're not going to be here in a year. They'd grown accustomed to that kind of turnover.
The CEO of the year club. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And so, you know, new person comes in, has a new vision, makes a lot of change, and then they're gone. And so the churn in the company was very, very high. So I had this hard challenge, which was we need to create change to modernize, digitize, and diversify. But I also have to create a sense of long-term decision-making and stability because we had been through so much churn. And, you know, listen, we started day one talking to people about the importance of talent and culture. And there's no question. I mean, you can look at the stock price. You can look at different metrics in the company. The thing I am most proud of is the culture change at the company. And I tell
you, where did it go from and to? How did that go?
Well, we defined it very specifically. It went from a command and control hierarchical culture to what we call literally a connected culture. More decisions farther from me, more based on trust and relationships, more based on speed. and literally teaching people things like, how do you assess risk? How do you make decisions? And I've learned, I think, over my career that you've got to go faster to innovate. Well, why do companies generally not go faster? A lot of times it's fear. Fear of what? Fear of making a mistake. Well, how do you teach people to be better decision makers? How do you teach people to assess risk?
Exactly.
And so those kind of things have been very powerful constructs to help the culture of the company evolve. And we're not done. You know, as we said earlier, like, these things are never complete. We're constantly working on culture and, you know, who we want to be when we grow up.
How many employees do you have now?
We, at headquarters, it's about 2,000 employees. Mm-hmm. And then we have this very, very unusual business model where we hire, train, and offboard 60,000 seasonal tax pros that on average have been with us about 11 years. So it's a
that is an incredible challenge. I can't imagine doing that every year.
Yeah, it's really a core competency for the company, thank goodness.
So back to the 2000, in the States, pretty conservative geography you live in, and then you got a lot of employees in India too. How did they take that culture shift, one, and then two, how actually do you teach them to approach risk? Give us the crib notes on their cheat sheet on how do we teach our employees to be more, not risk takers so much, but not being risk averse and knowing how to use it to grow. Because you're interested in growth and innovation.
That's right.
A pretty clear agenda.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, listen, it's easy now, 7 years in, to look back and paint a picture of everything being perfect. Obviously, yeah. That wasn't the case.
CEOs are good at that.
No,
and yeah. give us some of the dirt.
No, I mean,
that's
listen,
how we learn.
I'll tell you a very quick story. I was here about a week. I was doing business reviews to get up to speed on the business. I was asking a tremendous amount of questions. And a guy said to me at the end of the meeting, I have to say, I've never been through a meeting like that with any of the prior CEOs. And then he paused and he said, with all due respect, I've outlasted all of the other ones and I'll probably outlast you too. And Dean, in the moment, I thanked him for saying that. And I said, everyone is thinking it. I'm glad you put it out there. But let me ask you a question. Should you? And it rocked him more than I intended to be really honest. And I went on to say to him, listen, I can't talk about everything that's come before me. I can only tell you why I came and what I'm going to ask us to do. And I'm positive we won't be successful if I'm surrounded by people who are just trying to outlast me. And he quit about 6 weeks later.
Wow.
And it was one of those cultural moments where I've just always believed you have to create a culture where you can talk about everything that needs talked about. And so then you fast forward year after year after year of reinforcing our purpose, our behaviors, training people, getting momentum in the business so people, success cures a lot of problems.
Right.
And so then we literally have training programs done by our people and culture team on how do you assess risk? Because there's a risk in everything. But is it legal risk? Is it reputational risk? Is there risk in doing nothing because we're slowing down and missing a trend or a competitive move? We believe we can train people to get better at understanding types of risk so they gain more confidence in taking risk.
Seems like it's paying off. So you were the first president, I think, of Uber, and you were there at a pretty heady time. I knew the founder. We had him come to Chicago a few times and meet with a lot of the civic leaders and do the Uber talk. But it was messy and a scrappy era. So what'd you learn at Uber that, you know, helped you step into this mess at the time?
Boy, a lot of things. I mean, it probably was my personal professional reboot moment, for sure. You know, I probably spent 100 hours with Travis before he ultimately asked me to come run the company.
Wow. That's a long interview.
A lot of time. You know, I would fly.
Travis was pretty intense guy.
You know, he is the only person I've ever worked with ever that I would say is a genius.
Yeah.
I mean, the way he thinks about things was a very different perspective. So he asked me to come run the company. I wasn't looking for a job, by the way. I was trying to join their board. Mm-hmm. And I ultimately joined the company. And 6.5 months later, I made a very public ethical stand and quit. And all the things that are well documented now, I mean, Mike Isaac wrote the book Super Pumped. It's on Netflix.
Yep.
You know, this era was very well chronicled now, but none of it was public when I was there. It all started happening. And I learned the value of my values above all else. I'm obviously in a very nice job and make a great living as CEO of H&R Block, but the kind of generational wealth of what was possible in that job at that company before it was public was very intoxicating. And I left Uber with nothing. And on principle, I wanted nothing. And that's when you realize that you are making a decision about who you are and what you believe in. And ultimately, that was very inconsistent with Uber of that time. And so when that's tested, you know, you learn a lot about yourself, because I had no job. By the way, that company is full of incredible people. And so you're leaving something that has enormous potential, even at that time. But you just know that even with that title, you can't drive the change that you believe is necessary to grow up as a business. No. It was a very tough decision.
Well, you've had very conservative values. And I can't imagine you fitting in there, because there was a lot of, you know, everyone talks about how it was the Wild West and you need to take shortcuts and be innovative, but yeah, you also need to be ethical. And there was a lot of, you know, years later, it's all out, but it wasn't all out when you left. There was a lot of consternation and
absolutely
finger pointing and, you know, the value of your value, that's pretty, it's pretty provocative. To the point where you leave a lot of money on the table. No one does. Most people wouldn't do it. They'd close their eyes and sign a document and be like, okay, whatever.
Dean, I'll just one quick story. You know, when we talk about culture, and I tell people this all the time, one former colleague at Uber is currently in prison.
Right.
Another former colleague at Uber was headed to prison until he was pardoned by President Trump.
Yeah.
And so to your point, when you talk about culture, it wasn't like there was a bad boss. I mean, there were things happening there that I fundamentally couldn't be part of. And that's just a different level that I had never experienced. And especially hard because there are so many great people there.
Of course.
So
a lot of great, there's a lot of great people at Google as well, but the do no evil thing is kind of faded into the background. You know, anytime you go public, you've got quarterly earnings, but you know, Uber did a lot of interesting things. You were there. The kind of people will credit them for inventing surge pricing, though supply and demand's been around for centuries.
Yep.
To the point where everybody started copying it. Airlines, hotels, you name it, grocery stores will be next, for gosh sakes.
Now we call it dynamic pricing to make it
dynamic simple. Pricing. Yeah, they had to like de-emphasize the word surge. And, you know, I know both drivers and people, you know, thousands of people that use it. I just did a Forbes article about, you know, they never would have made it. It was all about the timing of, you know, with the smartphone evolution. So he hit it at the right time. Screen phones are booming. And before that, never would have happened. But
it wouldn't have been possible. That's right.
Yeah. So then you come into a very kind of almost too conservative culture. Everyone's afraid to make a move. And, you know, the tagline is, I'm going to outlast you. What else did you do to turn around and reboot?
I think, you know, people, this is weird to say about yourself, but I think what people would say about me is I'm a do what you say you will do kind of person.
Yep.
And so you're not making a bunch of big fake promises. You're just saying, here's what we have to do. We have to improve the quality. We have to digitize everything. We have to diversify. And then you start living your words through your actions. And those actions start to get results. And then people start to pay attention. And then you build momentum. And I think that's, you know, momentum is an intangible thing, but you can really see it starting to happen. And so, you know, do what you say you will do, incredibly important. We made some decisions that none of my predecessors had made, which reinforced to the team we were serious about rebooting this time. For example, we told Wall Street that our EBITDA margins were going to go from 30% to 25%.
I bet that was a fun meeting.
It was not a fun meeting, but it was it was essential. You know, the company was being harvested. And so none of my predecessors had done that. And so now the team says, okay, wait a second. We're actually making moves to invest in ourselves to do the things Jeff says we want to do. That builds credibility and momentum as well.
Jeff, did you have good mentors kind of growing up? You graduated military academy. I know that. So I can see some of that in you. How'd you get to where you are? We talk about mentoring a lot and coaching on the program because some of the best CEOs had it and some didn't. It's interesting.
I've never had a mentor.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, it's funny when you have the benefit, like I've had, of working for really world-class organizations and you do a good job there, those companies start investing in you and your development. And so I have a very clear sense of who I am as a leader, what I'm good at, where I need help. And I've always been a student of business. And there's something about, you know, growing up as a marketer, maybe you can relate to this too. I try to view the world very laterally. I get inspiration from places that have nothing to do with what we actually do.
Right.
And so I drive the team crazy sometimes because we'll be talking about doing something and I'll say, hey, does your wife shop at Stitch Fix? I want to talk about the way they do. What's that have to do with taxes?
Right.
Well, it has nothing to do with taxes. So just being incredibly curious, being a student of business, getting inspiration from places and things that have nothing to do with what we do. I mean, those things I think have served me well, but you know, I try to mentor other people in a big way today. And maybe that's a way of giving back because I never had one of those.
What kind of advice would you give, you know, the 22-year-old Jeff at this point?
I mean, I guess I would say a few things. Number one is, in my career, business has never been more dynamic. The problems are harder. They're more fun, but they're harder. There are all kinds of jobs being created today that never existed before. So I think your ability to have a career can be really dynamic now. That's pretty cool. The thing I try to always very tactically, you know, tell my college graduate daughters or tell a college class I'm in is the importance of learning and patience. And it's always easy to talk about patience in hindsight. But, you know, when you graduate school, it is very unlikely what you do is what you will be doing 5 or 10 years later.
Especially now.
And so just learn as much as you can. Take on that extra project. Do something outside of work to learn something new. You've got to build that baseline of curiosity and learning agility that will serve you in every future decade. And I just always try to instill that on really young people, how important that is. You think learning's over when you graduate, but it's just beginning.
Just beginning. Lifelong learning is so important. And everyone throws that term out without any guidance about, okay, here's what you can do. To me, it's so easy to do here in the 2020s. which means you have to be more selective and smart and focused. And so now everyone's like, hey, you should learn AI. I'm like, I'm not sure that's the best advice for John versus Sally. There's two different, so it's very situational. And you brought up a thing. It's like, how do you groom these people into next generation leaders? It's not the leadership lessons we were taught. It's the ones we're trying to teach now. I'm working on a book that touches a lot on, you know, how do you kind of be a part of the gig economy? I probably should include you in it because you're doing that with these 60,000.
They are.
You know, you don't need them all year long, but for some reason they still like you and they come back to you. That's my guess is you learned a little bit of that at Uber. That's probably a good crossover there. But anyway, the question in there is more about, you know, what do you think makes a good leader for the times ahead?
Well, I mean, listen, if work is more dynamic than ever, if problem solving is harder than ever, that's unlikely to change. I don't think there's any normal that's coming back. You know, it's we're going to create whatever's the next thing.
Exactly.
I think if that's the backdrop, being a great listener, knowing what questions to ask, being willing and vulnerable to communicate and connect. Never, you said lifelong learning. I would echo that. It's just those things are what leadership is today. And I believe they will be more important in the past. That old model of, actually, can I tell you another quick story?
Please.
A really cool thing happened to us recently, which is Harvard Business School has now written a case study on our transformation.
Yeah. Badge of honor there.
Really cool. And I had a chance in January to go join the former dean to teach the case for the first time.
Wow.
It was incredible. And I took live Q&A for an hour or so at the end, but the best question was the last question. And after a couple hours together, a woman said, I'm not really sure how to ask you this, but I'm kind of blown away by your openness, your transparency, your humility. And I just want to know, don't you have to be a shark to be a CEO?
A shark in a bad connotation.
In a very bad connotation. Well, that was in late January. Fast forward to last week, I had a follow-up conversation with Nitin Noria, who was the former dean, mm-hmm. before the case is now final. And he told me the number of students who have come up to him after the class with that same question, and how much the way I approached that class gave them hope that you can run a large company and you can drive very hard change and do it in a way that's open and transparent and vulnerable and empathetic. And that was inspiring to these students. And it never crossed my mind that would be a big deal.
How do you, you know, somebody's kind of wants to work for you in the next couple of years and you said, hey, go do this and then you'll be ready. What would you tell them now?
Well, the first thing I'll do is tell them about what hangs by the elevators in the lobby. Mm. Because I always tell them those are written there to remind people every day, what do the most successful people at Block have in common? And it says, act boldly, crave tough problems, demand high standards, and value winning as a team. Doesn't say anything about taxes, says nothing about financial services. It's an attitude about your approach to work. And those are the kind of people that we like to hire, and those are the kind of people that are successful. Almost by definition, Dean, we don't hire people from the industry 99% of the time. We hire people who are interested in those things, because that's the stuff we need to keep rebooting and transforming as a company. That's what I would tell them.
Yeah, it sounds like you came up to, my guess is those signs were not hanging by the elevator when you got
there. They were not.
And you probably had a big IRS culture there because being in the same geographic area, my guess is you hired a lot of people. Now it's all making sense to me.
Yeah.
So I like that. Right. Great advice, Jeff. Really appreciate you being on today.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You've been listening to Jeff Jones. He is the president and CEO of H&R Block. and maybe we can call him Block in the future here. This is Dean Tobias with the Reboot Chronicles. I want to thank you for joining us today. We'll see you soon.